You are listening to the Allen Gray Podcast. I am Inshalati Hlungwane, a manager in the institutional clients team at Allen Gray, and your host for this episode. The past decade and a half have been a fabulous time to own financial assets. Equity valuations seem to have been on an unstoppable upward trajectory, specifically in the US tech sector. And record low bond yields meant record high bond prices, a rewarding ride for those invested along the way. This is despite the tentative return to valuation rationality we saw in 2022. For quite some time, our offshore partner, Orbis, has been raising the alarm that there could be a regime change, characterized by stickier global inflation, rising geopolitical tensions, and higher risk-free rates, just to name a few. As markets focus on popular themes like AI and the Fed's next move, I am joined by Alec Cutler to help us cut through the noise. Alec is based in Bermuda and celebrates 20 years with Orbis this year. He leads the Orbis multi-asset team and has overall responsibility for the Orbis Global Balanced and Global Cautious strategies. Alec, welcome back to South Africa.
Thanks.
And to the Allen Gray Podcast.
Great to be here.
I'm really excited to have you back with us. You know, I always knew that you were in the Navy. But one thing I recently learned is that you actually do competitive sailing. Are there any lessons or anecdotes from that that you think are applicable to you as a stock picker, or lessons that you've learned from that?
Jeez, how much time do we have?
We've got all day.
It's a great question I've actually never been asked before. I think all sports are good training for investing. And if you think about it, there's the same sort of pyramid of success where – at the bottom of the pyramid, everyone has to have the requisite skills and techniques to get around a race course. But, you know, separating those who have that from those that don't is having the 10,000 hours of training, the discipline, the humility, the willingness to learn that take you to the next level. And then sort of at the top of the pyramid is an acute willingness to make decisions and showing that those decisions are good ones. Now, if I think of sailing and the global balanced and global cautious, it's also a lot of parallels. Anyone can do balanced investing, set up a fund and go for it. It's pretty simple. But doing it well is quite involved and requires a heck of a lot of attention, full time. And, you know, separately, in sailing, you need to know what your boat is capable of. And you can push it to the limit of that capability, but you can't push it further. If you think about balanced and cautious, you know, we're setting out to provide the best returns we can within a risk constraint. And to push it beyond that can produce disastrous results.
Mm-hmm. Also having the agility also to move as the current changes, which is actually what we're talking about in this case as well, with uncertainty, the movement in the markets. And so I guess you could probably draw that parallel as well.
Yeah, the conditions can change on the race course and you need to change what you're going to do with regard to setup or what direction you're going to go in or how hard you push.
Yes.
And you know, the last thing I think I'd want to mention is that anyone can win a race. If you have a 100-boat national championship, anyone can win a race. But there's only a very few that can win the whole event.
Sure.
And if you look at a typical world championship, the average winning score, winning finishing position over 10 races is like a 7 or an 8. So it's not about the number of wins you get or the number of years that your fund is the top-ranked fund. It's where you are after 10 years, after 20 years, after 30 years. Wow. And that's the way we think about it. We do not try and shoot the lights out every year. And in fact, some years we really throttle back because the uncertainty is high and we're not as confident that we have got a big enough gradient in the valuations in the fund. So we may throttle back, but we're also likely not to finish last. And you really made me contemplate it. So thank you.
I mean, I think that's a really great way to sort of set the scene, you know, when you talk about the uncertainty and the fact that you have to have the skill set and there is like this pyramid of success that you need to sort of follow. And that's applicable, like you say, also within the investing world as well.
I've met a ton of investors who've gone to the best schools, they've trained under the best people, they know all the techniques, they know how to fill out a spreadsheet better than anyone. And they meet management, they do all the work, and yet they never learn to be humble.
Sure.
Despite the fact that this industry, no matter how good you are, you get humbled every year mm-hmm. by something.
You've also mentioned, you know, the fact that it's not necessarily whether you shoot the lights out in 1 year, but it's also what happens over 10, 20, 30 years. One thing that also comes through when I read your commentaries, when I listen to you speak, is there's a lot of historical context. I've always wondered, or I've often asked myself, whether you consider yourself like a historian.
I consider myself a competitor. So it goes right back to the sailing analogy.
The sailing,
it
right.
is. What information can we gather, or what can we do to get an advantage over our competition? Oftentimes, there is a historic element to it. There's a pattern recognition, or there's a, you know, when was the last time we saw this kind of setup? Mm. Or, as is the case more recently, it's, wow, we've had one kind of an environment for 15, 16 years. You know, what's the next environment going to look like? Because
right.
it ain't going to look like this one.
Right, right.
You know, we've had 10 sunny, beautiful days with winds between 5 and 10 knots. That's not going to be what we're going to have tomorrow.
Mm.
So what do we need to change to get ready for that environment? What is it, when we look back in history, worked in that environment?
Mm.
And I think you're seeing a lot of historic anecdotes because we're coming out of one of those environments where everyone is transfixed and used to and is trained on the last 15 years, for many investors, probably the majority of professional investors, that's all they've ever known. And that's the way they're going to invest today.
Mm.
So it behooves us to go back and say, you know, what is the setup looking like? And let's go back at that period of time, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and see how things unfolded then. And, you know, how can we adjust the portfolio to optimize for those outcomes?
You were already an investor, I guess, or a stock picker back, you know, for example, when this particular cycle was sort of starting 15 years ago.
Well,
did you?
Yes.
Did
yes.
you recognize this back then?
That it was going to go 15 years?
Or that,
no.
Could you sense that there was a shift? Could you sense that there was like a regime change or?
I don't think that was a regime change. That was a much more of kind of an accelerator on the regime that existed at the time already.
Mm.
We already had, you know, many years of falling interest rates,
mm.
of easier money, of labor getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, mm. of outsourcing getting stronger and stronger and stronger, of energy prices dropping. So it was really more of an acceleration plus a big slug of liquidity being put in by the central banks. I can't put my hand up and say, hey, 2008, 2009, we rang the bell and saw mm. this new environment
mm.
because it really wasn't new. It was more of an acceleration of what we had already been experiencing.
Okay. So maybe now is a good time to sort of speak to multi-asset in more general terms, specifically within Orbis. We launched the Orbis Global Balance Strategy in 2013. So it's about 12 years now that the fund has been running. So I'm quite curious in terms of when you started the multi-asset portfolio and process, is it what you thought it would be today compared to when you started it back then?
It is, surprisingly so. We worked on it for 2 years before anyone even uttered the name. I think we did a decent job at anticipating the kind of environments that we could see.
Mm.
We designed Balanced and then Cautious to be able to produce the risk profile that we said we would,
mm.
provide the service that we said we would in any kind of investing environment for 50, 60, or 100 years. And we didn't think that we'd see the debt being completely uninvestable within the first 10 years, but we saw that extreme.
Right.
And we were able to produce the funds with investment profiles, risk profiles that were satisfactory. So we never went outside of our limits or were limited in how we could produce that risk profile. So in that respect, not surprised at all and gratified by, you know, how it's performed
mm.
and the environments in which it's performed. So, you know, full throttle forward.
You just said that you didn't necessarily foresee debt becoming uninvestable, which is quite interesting because, you know, when you think about multi-asset, it's usually, you know, you make the asset calls and then, you know, stock selection is almost the garnish on the side. How does Orbis sort of approach it given this?
So this is one of the key things that we set up for day one, and it came from looking at all of the global balance funds in the world, the bigger ones, and seeing that they had a fairly fixed ratio between fixed income and equities, you know, they would say they'd move that ratio around a little bit. Mm. But, you know, most were from equity firms that then got someone else to do the fixed income, or they did a passive fixed income, or fixed income firms that did the opposite. And what we thought was that can't be the optimal way to consistently produce a moderate risk profile. So the only other way we thought we could do it was to make every security compete with every other security. Mm. And some people thought we couldn't do that, but we've been doing it now for coming up on 14 years. And the bonds compete against the equities. The equities compete against the commodities. The commodities compete against hedged equity for a position in the portfolio. And we've been doing that for a long time now. The big benefit that we find from that is that it does increment the asset allocation. Mm. So the net equity weight has been as high as 75% of the portfolio, and it's been as low as it is now, mm-hmm. at around 55%. Mm. And that's purely coming from alternatives being more attractive.
With cautious being the new kid on the block.
The scared little kid.
Or the younger sibling. Of Global Balance. What led to the launch of Cautious?
Global Cautious came from the UK market, where we have a retail presence. And the UK market wanted a global equity fund, a global balanced fund that's moderate risk, and then at the bottom, a global cautious fund, mm-hmm. to take less risk. So that's where that came from 5-6 years ago. There's applicability for this market as well. So mm. we're happy to share it with you all.
What type of investor would Cautious be suitable for?
Right off the bat, it seems clear that there are a lot of investors and clients that have money, sometimes literally in the mattress, and they're not going to keep up with inflation by doing that. Mm. The service that we're trying to provide with this fund is to produce returns that are pleasing, but certainly beat a benchmark of U.S. bank deposit rate plus 2%.
Mm-hmm. What makes us think we've got an edge in terms of managing a cautious strategy?
We've been managing multi-asset strategies for a long, long time, over 30 years. We've been managing the Global Balance Fund now for 13, 14 years, if you include when we were practicing. And we've been managing the Cautious Fund now for 5. Mm. They are all different, but we're confident that we can, with the lineup of options that we have, within Orbis's universe of names that we like and investments that we like, that we can craft those options into a portfolio that meets the risk criteria that we have here.
Right. We've got global equity. We've got global balance. We've got global cautious. I mean, sometimes a person could be sort of excused for maybe thinking that cautious is maybe a scaled down version of global balance, for example. It is important to sort of make it clear that every portfolio is created de novo or from scratch. And I just wanted to sort of maybe give some practical examples. How is each fund created de novo? Maybe using cautious as a way of demonstrating that.
Let me back up for a second and just mention that it would be a heck of a lot easier and more financially efficient for the firm just to scale down global, just
right.
to take global's portfolio and put some hedging on it, or for in the case to produce balanced, or to produce cautious by scaling down balanced. That's not the optimal way to run it. The optimal way costs us a lot more money, takes a lot more attention, but we think produces a better result over time, and that is to treat each fund absolutely separately and say, starting from scratch with no other inputs, what's the best way to run this fund? Mm. You know, we have a dedicated team to balanced and cautious of 8 professionals that live and breathe balanced and cautious. Mm. I think a lot of firms wouldn't do that. They would just, you know, mechanically adjust the fund they have to reach a certain risk level. With regard to examples, Kinder Morgan is not owned by Global Equity. It is, we think, really well positioned for the multi-asset funds that are trying to produce a lower risk level.
Yes.
They own 40% of the gas pipelines in the U.S., so they're a major energy infrastructure company, pays a 7% dividend yield, and it's backed by a 10% free cash flow yield. that is inflation protected. The counterparties are mostly about 90% A-rated, so there's very little counterparty risk. They take a very small amount of energy price exposure. So it's a low-risk investment, produces a return that's better than bonds, and is sort of custom-made for the balanced funds. So we've got a big slug of that in balanced. And normally you would think that because the equity weighting is much lower, it's around half of balanced fund in cautious, that you would have a lower equity weighting. Mm. But the cautious funds have the same weighting in Kinder Morgan.
Sure.
Because it's really well suited for what cautious has set out to do. Now, Treasury inflation protected bonds, TIPS, are really interesting right now because they produce guaranteed return of inflation plus 2.5%. That's nice to have. We have 22% of the cautious fund in that because if you think about cautious fund's mandate, it's to effectively outperform inflation by 2%. Mm. So we have 22% of the portfolio that's guaranteed to outperform inflation by 2.5%. The balanced fund has a different mandate. It has a higher risk mandate. We've only got 6% of TIPS in the balanced fund. So those would be two examples of how they're managed differently.
I'm so glad you mentioned TIPS and I guess inflation, because that's actually a great segue into speaking to one of the biggest sources of uncertainty right now, which is inflation. You have been speaking for some time that inflation will be higher for longer, and we don't necessarily know where it's going to settle. But I'd be curious to know, what are the sources of this? Why do you think it'll be higher for longer?
I want to disclaim up front that higher for longer doesn't mean it can't go to zero next year.
I'm so glad you clarified that. It's more long-term, right?
Yes. The short term for us is impossible to predict. If the Fed can't do it with 700 economist geniuses, literally sitting in an ivory tower, then lowly old Orbis isn't going to be able to predict that. What we're referring to is the next 20 years,
right,
which is what's relevant for our clients. It doesn't really matter what inflation does over the next 6 months or a year. That might throw the portfolios around, but that's not really going to determine whether you meet your goals or not over the next 20 years. Now, if you think about it in the 20-year context, there's two ways you can think about whether that inflation is going to be well above 2% or hit a 2% inflation target. There's the monetary way, and then there's the historian's way. If you look at it from a monetary standpoint, the developed market governments around the world have become addicted to spending. But what's happening is, and if I use the U.S. as an example, the U.S. is running a financial deficit of 7%. It was 6% just 6 months ago. It's actually accelerating.
Sure.
That's the highest it's been since World War II. And it makes sense that you're going to spend a big percentage of your gross domestic product in deficit in wartime or a time of high unemployment or a deep recession.
Right.
We have none of those things.
Exactly, yeah.
The U.S. is in expansion, unemployment's low, and we're not in a war. It makes absolutely no sense if you think about it from a logic standpoint. But these guys want to get reelected. And what came out of COVID and before COVID was, in order to maintain economic growth, we need to stimulate more and more and more and more and more. And a big chunk of that right out of the global financial crisis was the central banks, so the Federal Reserve building its balance sheet up to at one point $11 trillion from zero. And that's just shooting money into the financial system.
Mm.
Until COVID, that money went to the banks, who then invested it and made a ton of money.
Mm.
So it created financial asset inflation.
Yes.
COVID changed that when the Federal Reserve made what may, when we look back in 50 years, be an absolutely epic mistake. They said, we've stimulated enough. Congress and the administration, you need to stimulate. You need to print money and give it to people.
Mm.
Helicopter money.
Mm.
That stimulus, to the tune of $6 trillion in 3 years, went to people who spent it.
Mm.
That started the inflation ball rolling. That inflation ball hasn't stopped.
Mm-hmm.
That was predicted not to happen, by the way.
Right.
If you go back to their predictions, they talked about transitory.
Yes.
They talked about, you know, having trouble getting to 2% inflation. and then it was going to be really easy to get that transitory inflation back to 2%. Well, 3 years later, they still say it's no problem. Yes. We have the toolkit to get back to 2%, but they're struggling to get it under 4%. That's what higher for longer is being referred to right now.
Yes.
They may well succeed over a short period of time because of things like base effects or just the randomness of the world. You could have oil prices go down to $40 and you'll get 0 or 1% inflation. But that monetary printing of money produces inflation. Mm. It has always produced inflation in any economy in the world. Mm. And that's one way to look at and say, you know, over the next 20 years with the level of money printing, the fact that they had to print more to keep the economy going, they had to print more just to pay the interest expense. Mm. Interest expense alone, I don't want to digress too far, but interest expense alone has gone from $500 trillion to where the run rate at the end of this year is locked in at $1.6 trillion a year. To put that in context, the entire U.S. Sure. defense budget is $800 billion a year.
Sure.
It is just skyrocketing.
Yeah.
And the longer interest rates stay high, this higher for longer, and why it's so damaging and why the Treasury is trying to lean very, very heavily on the Fed to lower short-term interest rates is you have another $17.4 trillion coming due over the next 2 years of treasuries, and the average interest rate on those is under 3%. Mm. So if those all get refinanced at over 5%, that interest expense explodes again.
Absolutely.
So they need to print more money and more money and more money just to keep this plate spinning on the end of the stick. Mm. The monetarists would say that's purely inflationary. They're never going to reach their goal because they're working against their goal every time they issue way more treasuries than they're extinguishing. The other way we look at it is historically, for the last 40 years, we've had deflationary impulses. Mm. And to categorize them, one would be – the first and biggest one would be labor. Mm. Labor until the early 80s ran the United States – industrial complex. Mm. Same with the UK, same with Europe. In 1981, Reagan fired the Air Traffic Controllers Union. Mm. They were the strongest union in the country. And he basically went in the schoolyard and said, you know, who's the biggest bully on the schoolyard, and punched him in the nose. From there, labor's been on its back foot, accelerated massively by China joining the WTO, causing a massive outsourcing wave, offshoring wave, that enabled any industrial company in the U.S. to say, if you don't like this pay package, auto union, we're going to move our auto production to China.
Right.
Or parts production or whatever. And so that's been 40 years, 40-plus years of labor being on its heels. That's changed dramatically recently. We've had very low unemployment. We're trying to onshore to bring all that industry back from China, back to the U.S., back to nearshoring Mexico, back to friendshoring Japan or the U.K. or Europe. And if it was deflationary to move it offshore,
it will clearly be the opposite.
It's going to be the opposite to bring it onshore. Mm. With that multiplier effect of now you're giving labor more and more power. Mm. So those two things interact tremendously as two pendulums that swung really far one way and are now swinging really far the other way. The other pendulum started in 1989, the end of the Cold War, the Berlin Wall fell. So we had from 1989 until recently, we had what people called the peace dividend. Mm-hmm. And that was long enough for everyone to get used to that and say, that's normal. Mm. So we have about 9% of the portfolio in defense stocks. And people look at us and say, oh, yeah, well, that made sense when, you know, Russia was invading the Ukraine or when we had issues in the Middle East. But we're going to go back to normal. And I asked them what normal is. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh, it's, you know, what we've had for the past 30 years. I said, well, let's do a history lesson. Mm-hmm. In the 5,000 years that we've had the written word, humans have been bashing each other on the head. That's normal. We only have this 30-year period of relative peace. Mm. We're animals.
Yeah.
And if you're afraid of being dominated, you dominate. Mm. You try to dominate. That is the human condition. The last 30 years has been an anomaly. we feel quite comfortable that we're moving into a normal environment, back into a normal environment, that has defense spending ramping up around the world. Defense spending is non-productive.
Mm.
No one can prove to me that a tank produces anything.
Mm.
It protects your ability to produce things. In fact, it protects your ability to have things like ESG movements,
mm-hmm.
or liberal thought, or democracy, freedom of movement, all the things that we treasure at the bottom of our free society pyramid are protected by defense spending.
Mm.
But it is non-productive and therefore inflationary.
Mm.
So those are three big pendulums that are now swinging back the other way. The one that isn't a pendulum, I guess we could call it a pendulum, that's sitting in the middle and we're going to chuck it one way, that's going to be inflationary, is what a lot of people are calling the energy transition or the decarbonization of the economy and society. That is all very inflationary. And it was sold to us in the beginning of the ESG movement or war on carbon movement as deflationary, ironically. You know, let's just put up windmills and solar panels and they'll produce free power.
Mm.
So any place that's done that, the UK has led the world in that. You know, ask, how's it going for you?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because power prices have gone up.
Mm-hmm.
Wherever anybody have put these supposedly free sources of power in, because they wreak havoc on the power grid.
Mm-hmm.
And they make for a much more volatile grid. And that requires you to have other sources of energy that can fit in when needed on call, which is a very expensive thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
So the grids have all become unbalanced. But that's just the one that we see now. All our power bills have gone up. That's inflationary. The part of the energy transition that we don't see and kind of ignore is the true industrials.
Mm-hmm.
We basically mandated that every cement plant, every chemical plant, every manufacturing plant convert from whatever energy source they were using to electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And to use cement as an example, there's a cement plant in the Netherlands that is converting from using natural gas to burn limestone and get cement as the byproduct of burning that limestone to electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to cost them $2 billion
sure.
to make that transition. They're going to have to amortize that cost over 50-pound bags of cement or 50-kilo bags of cement or however they denominate it. For the next 30, 40 years, however long they depreciate that CapEx. But secondly, if it was cheaper to do it with electricity, they would have done that from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
So every pound of cement they make is going to be more expensive from now on, and that has to be passed through to the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
So this greening of industry is purely inflationary.
Mm-hmm.
It's just math. All of this is just math. That's why we're more comfortable doing this than thinking about how a monetarist would view inflation. But either way you cut it, whether the monetarists are saying, hey, the more money you print, the more inflation we're going to have in future, or we look at it and we say, let's create a layer cake starting at 2%, which the economists say is the natural inflation rate that you need to have a lubricated economic system, and add those impulses on, you know, we get to 4.5% minimum on average over the next 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Either way you do it, you're a heck of a lot higher than 2%.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is the Western economies, certainly not South Africa, you'd be fine with 4.5%. But your system is designed that way.
Mm.
The American system or the UK system or the European system or the Australian system or the Japanese system, Korean system is not.
Mm.
It's designed for 2% inflation.
Mm.
So 4.5 throws it for a loop, and it comes out in things like earnings getting hit hard.
Mm.
It comes out in bonds having to be revalued to much higher yields.
Mm.
Bringing it home to our portfolio, we have no appetite to invest in U.S. 10-year treasuries yielding 4.4% or 4.35 today.
Yeah.
When we think inflation could be 4, on average over the next 10 years, could be 4.5.
Mm.
We're losing money,
losing
purchasing power for our clients by investing in those bonds.
Mm.
And oh, by the way, along the way, if inflation is – people admit that inflation's higher, you get a capital loss in those bonds as well. So we're not willing to do that. That's where the tips come from.
Alec, the dollar has been strong for quite some time, which I think seems very counterintuitive considering the level of debt that the U.S. government has. You know, what is your thinking around this, and how does the portfolio sort of manage this overhanging risk over it?
Let me mention two things up front. One, people look at the dollar right now and they just assume it's always strong. The dollar was quite weak from, say, 99 to 2010. The dollar was undervalued. We were extra long the dollar. Now we're short the dollar because it looks way too expensive to us. The other bit of context is the way we manage currencies. We're not trying to produce alpha. We do over the – in the fullness of time, our portfolios do tend to produce some extra return from the way we manage currencies, but that's not how we're looking at it.
Right.
We're looking at trying to preserve our clients' purchasing power. It's only when a currency gets so far out of whack in being overvalued that we're worried about its ability to hold purchasing power that we then seek to ameliorate it somehow. And the mechanism we have for doing that is by shorting the futures. When we do that, we have to find something else on the other side.
Right.
You can't just short the dollar. You have to short it against something. Right now, we think the dollar is expensive. We went through some of the reasons why inflation in the U.S. is going to be higher than people think. That makes us particularly worried about the dollar because it's going to decrease in value against things.
Yes.
For sure. And other countries haven't been as, let's say, grandiose in their spending and willingness to spend. And in a way, if you think about it, the U.S. has been overplaying its hand as the world's default currency. And that could end if people get sick of them saying, why are we supporting this country that just keeps spending like crazy? We're short to the tune of about 16% absolute shorts in the U.S. dollar. On the other side of that, about a little less than half is made up of the yen. All the best contrarians and value investors I know are traveling to Japan for vacation now because the yen is so cheap. That cheapness of the currency, the value for money that you get from that currency becomes a self-fulfilling correction in and of itself eventually. It may take a long time to get back to purchasing power parity, but from a purchasing power parity standpoint, the yen is 60 to 75% undervalued. The second big currency position is in the Norwegian kroner. The kroner has performed in line with the rand now for the last 1, 3, 5, 7, and 10 years. That might make sense. They're both sort of resource currencies, but Norway has a surplus every year. Doesn't have a deficit spending. It has $200 billion in debt. It has a $1.6 billion sovereign wealth fund. Has a massive surplus. It's the richest country in the world. That's our second biggest currency position because when the world stops being fascinated by yield differential and carry trades and short-term picking up nickels in front of a steamroller type FX investing trades, not strategy trades, they will revert to things like who's got the strongest balance sheet, what is the cheapest purchasing power currency in the world, and they'll go to the yen and they'll go to the Norwegian kroner.
On that note, there's a couple of points that you've actually raised in describing the drivers, especially from the perspective of defense spending, ESG transition, all of that. Everything that you've painted is, I guess, creating this world of uncertainty. What then are the options available to a multi-asset investor in terms of, you know, in this inflationary world?
People sort of ask us, wait a second, you think that the global stock market's overvalued and government bonds are uninvestable.
What's left?
What's left? The first thing would be that global equities are expensive on an aggregate basis, but that's being driven by very few names that are very, very large. I mean, the quote-unquote Magnificent Seven, each one, the average market cap is bigger than the market cap of Germany, of all the stocks in Germany added together. When you scratch the surface, the average stock is not that expensive. It's sort of fairly valued. That means that half the stocks in the world are cheap, We've got plenty of stuff that we can look at. Mm-hmm. And we have plenty of companies that we can invest in where we believe they'll do just fine in a world of 4, 4.5, 5%, maybe 6, 8% inflation. Some of them benefit by a higher inflationary environment and are kind of being held back by this notion that, inflation's going to be fixed at 2, 2.5%, no problem. Mm. They're being undervalued because of that. So we feel comfortable on the equity side. Mm. We also, on the equity side, have the ability to hedge. So we can invest in those names or, say, cyclicals that may or may not have that same level of investment protection. We think they do, but we think have, strong secular drivers like semiconductors or companies that participate in the rebuilding of the critical energy infrastructure around the world that we think just have an advantaged future. And we can hedge out by shorting the market indices, which are, priced over the odds. Mm-hmm. To us, that feels like a really good thing for us to do if we're confident in what we do and all the research that we do. And one of the benefits of that, just thinking of inflation again, one of the benefits of hedging is that 18% of the portfolio, we carry 18% hedging in both balanced and cautious, right now produces a 5.5% tailwind. So that in and of itself may beat inflation or may be closer to inflation. So it may be an inflation-proof section of the portfolio. And the math behind that is if we own our names, we own our stocks, and we hedge out a portion of those stocks by shorting in indices, that indices is a three-month future that we're shorting. Mm-hmm. That three-month future is priced based off a 90-day T-bill. Mm-hmm. That 90-day T-bill happens to be yielding 5.5%. So if you hold those two positions for 90 days, they come together and the valuation of one comes down to the valuation of the other, producing a 5.5% return. That's how that works. Mm. So it is mechanical, and we're happy to have that ability. So relative to 2 years ago when that 90-day T-bill had a yield of zero, we didn't have that tailwind. Yes. So that's kind of a wonderful part of the portfolio.
Yes.
We mentioned tips before. Mm. We can have a big chunk of the portfolio in tips. And tips right now, inflation plus 2.5%, thinking about the cautious fund, everything else in the cautious fund has to beat that. Mm. That's what we think about right now in cautious fund. So, what beats that? Well, we think hedged equity can beat that. Mm. So we have a slug of hedged equity. We think gold, which actually has similar drivers, the real interest rate tends to drive gold and tends to drive tips. But gold also has this geopolitical call option to it. So when the world is exploding, the world is catching on fire, gold goes bonkers. So we carry in both funds, we're carrying between 10 and 11% in gold and gold miners. So pretty soon you can create a portfolio that, when we look at and when we hope when our clients look at carefully, they say, this actually looks like a really well put together, creative, cautious portfolio or balanced portfolio. That's our goal. And that's what we can control. And we're very happy that we have these levers, the latitude to be able to do that within our mandates. And we didn't, as I said before, we didn't think we'd be exercising them like this much, but we're glad we can.
And I think that speaks to that original discussion we had around multi-asset and the approach to it is the fact that there is this flexibility and each security needs to compete with the other security as opposed to being so focused on, what asset class are we in or making sure you're maximizing each asset class, which is really fantastic. It would be remiss for us to have this conversation without speaking to the golden children of, I guess, the stock market right now, which would be the AI world, the Microsofts, the NVIDIAs.
After the global financial crisis, we were buying those names and we were able to buy Apple and Microsoft at 10 times earnings when they were, thought to be on the back of their heels and, mature tech companies. We owned Google. We owned Meta. We sold them in 2018-19. when, you know, we were taking them from 10, 11 times earnings to what we thought were very full valuations at 20 to 24 times earnings. Mm. The market back then was maybe 15 times earnings. As we described before about competition for capital in the portfolio, we had other names that were pulling that capital out of those, what we thought were fully valued names. You know, then they went on to triple again and embarrass us and lead to a period of underperformance. So, you know, it is embarrassing that the names that you held are the names that drove your embarrassment.
Right. But remember when you started, you spoke about the humility element as well, you know?
Yes.
It's a big part of this.
It is. And you can't get too down on yourself. You just have to start each day anew. And we buy the portfolio every day. Mm. You know, these are selling at very, very high multiples now. But I will commit to you now that at some point in the next 20 years, we'll own them all again.
Mm.
It'll be at a period where people are looking at us and saying, how could you possibly own those names?
Mm.
We'll be there again. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how we know we're hunting in the right area when we're told that we're crazy for owning something.
Mm.
If we're to look at them now afresh, you know, they have challenges. Mm. They're valued as if they have none. They're valued as if they are in control of their destiny. But there's always something. Everything has a fat tail risk.
Mm.
And if you think about it and you think about AI, those names were actually starting to roll over because they've got a lot of weight on top of them.
Mm-hmm.
They need to find a new total addressable market that is absolutely massive. When you have the market cap of Germany,
yes,
you need to find a brand new area that's going to be big enough to move
to
the dial
be able
for
to
you.
Continue.
Because if you take Amazon, for example, Amazon has already eaten up all of retail.
Mm-hmm.
It is already cloud computing, which was their next thing, is sort of rolled over in growth. They need to find the next thing.
Mm.
They tried healthcare.
Mm.
Think of healthcare was appropriate for them because it's so massive.
Mm-hmm.
If they get it right, they can actually move the dial.
Mm.
They got back out of healthcare. They got in. They were like, this is a scary area, and got back out. They're struggling to find where to go next.
Mm.
So all of those names started kind of rolling over. And investors started saying, wait a second, you haven't grown in 2 years.
Mm.
We can't have this 30, 35 price to earnings multiple on you right now. You can't sustain that. And then AI shows up this time last year. Microsoft says, oh, we did a deal with ChatGPT, and NVIDIA came out and said your earnings expectations are 100% too low. And it's just, wow, off to the races again.
Mm.
All those magnificent seven said, this is our next total addressable market.
Mm.
This has got infinite growth to it.
Mm.
No one's actually explained what that growth is to me satisfactorily yet. I'm not sure what the total addressable market is. Don't really know. Maybe it's there, but they need it.
Mm.
They're valued at a price where they actually need that to happen, in my personal opinion. Now, the other way that you could look at it is they're in fear, because the one thing you can say about AI is it's lowered barriers to entry.
Mm.
And all of those companies, all those very successful tech companies, have a kind of crown jewel that produces a lot of free cash flow for them where they have higher barriers to entry. And there's a question now that's been asked as to whether they do have that because AI has lowered the barrier.
Mm.
And the other way you could look at it, and maybe this is how they have their internal meetings, not their external meetings, where they talk about the massive TAM that's coming to them. But their internal meetings could go something like this. We got to win. If we don't win, we're stuffed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's no way that we're going to sell at 35 times earnings if we finish third.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've spent our entire lives having to be number one or number two in tech.
Mm-hmm.
Number three, four, five, six, seven, you're out.
Yeah.
What are we going to do?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to spend like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to spend 100 billion to build out these AI factories, whatever it takes, we need to win or at least finish second. And they look around at each other and there's seven. So only two can win. They're being valued as if they're just perpetual winners.
Mm.
And if you look at even NVIDIA is right now, some people say it's gone from the magnificent seven to the only one.
Yes.
But what people aren't paying attention to, because they're so excited about it, and they're still trying to learn how to spell it, is that NVIDIA has low barriers to entry over the long term. It's producing the best chips for AI right now. It has the best architecture for AI chips called CUDA. But its customers, those Magnificent Seven, have unlimited budgets. They have incredibly talented people. They all have semiconductor design wings. And oh, by the way, there's no employment law in Silicon Valley of note. They can hire away NVIDIA's engineers if they want, and they can walk right across the street. There's no law against that. They are working really hard to create an alternate standard from CUDA. Why are they doing all this? They don't want to keep paying NVIDIA $55,000 for a chip. And biggest issue of them all is that NVIDIA doesn't manufacture their chips. It's outsourced. They're a high return on invested capital company. They design chips that Taiwan Semiconductor makes for them. Taiwan Semiconductor doesn't care if they're making an NVIDIA chip or a Qualcomm AI chip or a Google AI chip or an Apple AI chip, which are all being designed. They'll make them for anyone, and they offer the same services. So NVIDIA has some significant risks and challenges that they need to deal with, not in the next 6 months, maybe not in the next year, but certainly after that.
So is this why you say Taiwan Semiconductor is the most important company in the world?
Yes, absolutely. They produce 90% of the world's leading edge semiconductors. That's what NVIDIA uses. That's what Apple uses.
And that's a company you've been holding for quite some time, actually.
From the start of the fund, yes.
Yeah.
I've known it since it IPO'd in the U.S. in the mid-90s.
What other AI names do we hold in the portfolio?
If you think of AI and you think of the inner ring would be what everyone talks about on CNBC and Bloomberg being Microsoft and NVIDIA. The ring right outside that are those that are providing the ammo to the system. And that would be Taiwan Semiconductor making the chips, Samsung and Micron as the DRAM producers. That's sort of that first ring around it where that we find investable because, not just because they sell it at very inexpensive multiples relative to that inner ring, but because they don't care who's in the inner ring. They don't. Whoever's in that inner ring has to buy those things from them. Much higher barriers to entry.
Considering the fact that you have this whole world to invest in, how do you think about China, given the prevailing risks, but also the very cheap valuations?
So we peaked in our China tech weighting, I think maybe 4 years ago at 8%. And to show, again, just to reference and give context around the differences, when balance was at 8% in Chinese tech names, global was at 24%. And at that time, we hedged out some of the tail risks by going short the currency. So 8% short the Chinese renminbi at the same time to reduce risk. We sold that that position 4 years ago, maybe, when they appreciated tremendously and China was the place to be. Who knows, man? That could have gone off like the American tech stocks and gone off to triple and quadruple again. It didn't. It went back to where they're selling at single-digit multiples again at the beginning of this year. We started dipping our toe in a little bit, you know, nothing more than a percent and a half. And to, again, deal with the risk that, you know, China, if China invades Taiwan, those positions will go to zero, much like the Russian names. So we hedge that risk with, one, the Taiwan dollar, the Chinese renminbi, and the Chinese enterprise index. So we've gone long Tencent and Alibaba and NetEase. We're 100% hedged for a big risk.
Okay. We
also, it needs to be noted that that's not our prime exposure to China. Our biggest exposure to China is Taiwan Semiconductor.
Absolutely.
We really like Taiwan Semiconductor as an investment, but there is a big risk there. There's a sort of Damocles of a Chinese invasion of Taiwan. If that happens, Taiwan Semiconductor will go down 80%. But the Taiwanese dollar will go down 100%. So we're short the Taiwanese dollar. But the risks extend past that. It sort of, we marvel at the fact that, you know, Apple has no China risk in it, no perceived China risk in it. The valuation isn't depressed, even though all of Apple's products are made in China, still, the vast majority of them, they may say designed in Cupertino, but they're made in China.
Yes.
It's their biggest market, their biggest single market for growth and earnings. Gucci, LVMH, all the luxury companies, if you look at where they get their revenues and earnings, it's from China. They don't seem to bother or mind. Mm. It's only Taiwan Semiconductor that seems to have this big discount. So we're buying Taiwan Semiconductor at a big discount, owning it at a big discount, and trying to hedge out the downside risk.
Mm. To sort of close off our conversation, what type of environments will make the multi-asset funds look good and make us look smart, and what will make us look stupid?
So stupid's always easier than smart. We'll look stupid if we return to the, you know, super low rate, low growth environment where you pay a big premium for those few special companies that, you know, grow no matter what. Mm. You know, that might take the rebuild the Magnificent Seven and send them off to 70 times earnings. I don't know.
Sure.
The problem with that is they're already very expensive. Yeah. So you're starting from a high base. But that will be a difficult environment for us. What will make us look smart would be if indeed over the next – and 6 months is way too short, by the way. You can't grade us on that. It's a two-year minimum on this. But if over the next 2 years we don't have recognition that inflation is going to be higher long term and that implied inflation in fixed income markets doesn't move up, that'll be tough for us, but we think it will. So what will make us look smart will be a recognition that inflation over the next 20 years is actually going to be quite a bit higher than this mythical 2%.
Thanks, Alec, for joining me. We chatted through a range of themes affecting the global opportunity set, but there are some clear takeaways for this conversation. Firstly, all the multi-asset portfolios at Ellen Gray and Orbis are built from the bottom up, and asset allocation is the result of security selection. And this doesn't change, even when uncertainty abounds. Secondly, as valuation-orientated, contrarian investors, we focus on the fundamentals. And lastly, while short-term performance may be influenced by the macroeconomic environment and market sentiment, long-term success is determined by an investor's skill. If you would like to get in touch, please send an email to info@ellengray.co.za. You can subscribe to this podcast on your preferred platform to be notified of new episodes. Lastly, Ellen Gray is an authorized FSP. To view our terms and conditions, please visit ellengray.co.za. Until next time, I'm Shalati Hlungwane. This podcast is produced by Volume Podcasts.
Time. When you're a kid, it moves slower than a sloth trying to get through airport security. There is just so much of it. Skip forward a few years to your 20s. Time is still your friend. It says have some balance. Go party and have fun. Then your 30s hit. And time suddenly steps on the accelerator like it's trying to catch a traffic light before it goes red. 40s. Now time is moving faster than your 10-year-old on a sugar high. 50. You're desperately trying to save as much as you can, but time is moving so fast. And all you can think is, where did all the time go? That's why after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time for some much-deserved you time. Now, isn't that a compelling enough reason to invest? Ellen Gray, long-term investing. Ellen Gray is an authorized FSP.